Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I'm sorry that we were having some technical problem. Sorry for the delay. Anyhow, let's start now. For this afternoon, we are going to have session number three, which is Bretton Woods at 80. First of all, it's the overview on the achievements and failures of Bretton Woods system. The system was established in 1944, and then after 27 years of operations was halted by the close of the gold standard window. And then we're interested in knowing what it achieved and what weaknesses that it contained. And then on this highly interesting topic, we are to hear, first of all, Professor David Wines from Oxford University to talk about the place of the international monetary system in the 21st century global economic governance. So let's invite Professor David Wine, please. David Wines.
First of all, let me say what a pleasure it is to be here with you all. Thank you. Looking back 100 years, World War II marked a vital transition for global economic governance. In the period before World War I, 100 years ago, the world had experienced a kind of globalization very like what we've been going through until recently. But the 1930s saw a retreat from this amidst massive unemployment and policies which were in the end about the preparation for war, which involved very clear beggar thy neighbour macroeconomic responses. After the war, the world faced a choice, and this choice was brought upon the world by the new hegemon rising into its place, determined to unpick the imperial preference, which had been so important for the British Empire. And having signed Clause 7 of the Lend-Lease Treaty with Britain, which gave the US the possibility of dictating what the post-war world would look like to the shrinking hegemon so exhausted from war, namely the UK. There's a similar choice facing the world now with the election of Donald Trump. What exactly is the US going to require of the world as we go forward? The parallel being, what exactly was the US going to require that Britain and others did immediately after the Second World War? Keynes came to the following conclusion when confronted with this challenge by the US. Supposing that the US was determined to impose free trade on the world and on Britain, and what's more, was determined to unravel the system of imperial finance which had been in place, what did the UK, as a defender of those other countries and itself the declining hegemon, need to do in order to stand up to this pressure? And the view that he came to, and those working with him, was that the position of the UK could only be maintained if trade were freed on a global basis against the background of managed international finance and with the possibility of countries actively pursuing full employment policies. But the UK faced a protectionist United States. And though the US had rhetoric with free trade, its actions were somewhat different, something which is familiar to all of us at the moment. Before I go to describe what it was that was put in place, let me just remark that many in Parliament in Britain, as the run-up to the Bretton Woods Conference gathered pace, turned to Keynes and said, if the problem is that the US is determined to undo imperial trading processes, why have you spent 3 years preparing for the Bretton Woods meetings, which are all about finance? And Keynes gave a wonderfully clear account of a reply, which I've printed there in detail, but which roughly said macroeconomics is important. If you try and do negotiations about tariffs and trade against a macroeconomic system that isn't working, and he was thinking of the gold standard, you're going to end up arguing round and round in circles about nothing. First fix the macro and then do the trade. So 3 years after, I'm still making sure that I go up and down in the right order. Let me just check. There we are. 3 years after these initial discussions and leading up to that time of criticism that I described, came to have a view that four things were needed. Aggregate demand satisfactory for the world, international adjustment of current account balances somehow possible, a system of international lending which would both manage short-term volatility but also ensure that finance and capital flowed to emerging market economies. They didn't use that phrase, but that's what they meant at that time. And finally and crucially, enable countries to specialise on what they did best, do export-led growth, be in a world in which trade was liberalising. But you've got to, those are the objectives, you've got to see how to do it. And here is a description of what was happening at Bretton Woods and around Bretton Woods. The first line is full employment policies. Here's the man who'd written the general theory in 1936, which was all about that, national governments doing demand management essentially by fiscal policy. But crucially, second line, not being in a position where balance of payments deficits, whenever they attempted to go for full employment, would prevent this policy from being executed. Pegged but adjustable exchange rates. We talked about that system earlier this morning. the exchange rate weren't just pegged, they were adjustable. Countries in current account deficits would be able to and would be expected to devalue so that to get out of their difficulty, they didn't need to have protectionism or austerity. And invent an institution, the IMF, to do this. Thirdly, the bottom line, alongside the IMF, there was to be an institution required for promoting international development, for doing this lending, as described a minute ago, and that was to be the World Bank, in the end opposite each other in 19th Street in Washington. But fourthly and crucially, there was to be an international trade organization promoting international trade, trade liberalization, export-led growth by means of negotiations to reduce tariffs. As we all know, the US Congress prevented the creation of the World Trade, of the International Trade Organization, but the general agreement in tariffs and trade filled the place, roughly speaking. This is a structure of global economic governance, and it was multilateral and it was unipolar. And why was the hegemon, the new hegemon, keen to play games, to play ball, to participate in this? Three reasons. It itself embraced full employment Keynesianism. very strongly supported by what political scientists have described as a climate in which everybody felt engaged in the process of being looked after by the pursuit of domestic macroeconomic. This was a period of the beginnings of the welfare state in Britain, similar things elsewhere, nobody to be left behind. Secondly, the US as technological leader wanted this world order, embracing free trade, opportunities for FDI, the whole works. And thirdly, of course, the Cold War meant that the Marshall Plan could be added on top of this. Notice that this is a system. And when you get a locking together system, the benefits of free riding, exiting, playing badly begin to look dodgy. And so when free riding looks dodgy, you know you've nailed down something that's sustainable and manageable. That's 1944, 5, 6, 7, and into the 50s. What the French call the Trente Glorieux, what we just call the Golden Age, between 1945 and 1971. But it collapsed, and we heard this morning about the collapse of this system. But I'm going to tell you a slightly different story about the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. There were very confused discussions in the early 70s when this fell apart. And in an issue of the Oxford Review of Economic Policy, which Paola and I edited a year and a half ago, we had a wonderful paper by Barry Eichengreen, in which he said, no new exchange rate system agreed by everybody, no proper adjustment process, no global regulation of international liquidity, no fixing how to manage the SDR. And Max Corden put his hand up and said, this is a non-system. But non-system or not, this was remade. Once floating exchange rates were understood, and alongside floating exchange rates, you can't do floating exchange rates with no domestic nominal anchor, you get hyperinflation. But how long did it take the world to learn this? Basically 20 years, to put inflation targeting in place. New Zealand, the UK, others, 1991. That's 20 years after the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. And so my nice picture still survives. The second row, balance of payments adjustment, is now floating exchange rates in an open international market position. And the first line, interestingly, fiscal policy doing demand management, turns into monetary policy. But with those two amendments, this system is up and running again. And crucially, it's open for trade liberalisation, and there's the Uruguay round, and the show goes on. So don't look at the collapse of the Bretton Woods system as the end of the order. Look at it as a transition point. And now I once gave a talk like this, and at the IMF, and Olivier Blanchard said, David, you're doing the history of the world in 20 minutes. That's what I'm trying to do. So we have to go a few more years further. After that remade system was in place, there were some very significant challenges. And here I've identified the three most important ones. The global financial crisis of 2007-08. If you try and run that system and are very proud of it, and then do financial deregulation and tell everybody they can run any old kind of bank they feel like, it's no surprise that you end up with a global financial crisis. But we know, or we think, until this last election in the US, we thought we knew how to deal with this. It's not clear that we won't get so much deregulation again that this whole show happens all over again. In that period after the GFC, when there was austerity in a way which we could discuss at great length, and low world interest rates, markets for exports of emerging market economies were not growing rapidly, but they could borrow, and they did, and there's a build-up of debt. There's a when normalizing happened at the early 20-teens, there was an emerging market debt crisis for developing countries which never really materialized. But now we have, as we've heard earlier in our discussions, debt overhang and the need for resolution, which is really very serious. And thirdly, there was the COVID pandemic, which was managed by spectacular fiscal expansions amongst advanced countries, and the invention of vaccines remarkably quickly. But emerging market economies are still with yet more debt accumulation and not having had this fiscal space to deal with this, still suffering enormously. That's head of that slide partly dealt with. So just to go back, 1971, collapse of the Bretton Woods system, but kind of dealt with. That's my story. Subsequently, three challenges which happened, again kind of dealt with. But what I'm now going to tell you is the real difficulty that we're in for, quite ahead of this election that we've just experienced. And it goes like this. The third line of this wonderful picture, which I keep on showing you because I'm so proud of, no longer works. There is no longer a World Trade Organization of caliber which can help the promotion of export-led growth and international trade liberalizations. So my story is that this is now really serious for us in a way that is much more serious than any attack that's ever happened before. Of course, what's happened, as we heard this morning, is a challenge to the WTO rules, but as an intellectual economic theorist, I want to tell you that it's not just bad practice, it's also a lack of any coherent ideas. Right back at the beginning of my story, Keynes invented full employment capitalism to fix an unemployment problem. In the 1970s, the world invented floating exchange rates and nominal income targeting to keep the show on the road. Now we don't yet know what to invent. That's my intellectual point, because the WTO is founded on 19th century Marshallian perfect competition economics. Supply curve, demand curve, when you see a tariff that interferes with the workings of the market mechanism. The task of this organisation is to simply look for trade barriers and have discussions about bringing them down. Is this the way to think about the competition amongst Amazon and Google and the big tech players? Of course it's not. Just as we know that domestic competition policy has been reconstructed to deal after telecoms regulation with imperfectly competitive industries. That's not a problem for Marshallian microeconomics, and nor is fixing the WTO. I've listed there an emerging consensus which I believe will begin to help us understand what to do. But now I'm just going to talk to you, and I'll overrun a little bit in doing so, about the five challenges which I'll describe, which make it essential that we understand what to do about reconstructing the World Trade Organization and trade rules. First of all, the globalization of trade has led to inequality. And in the US, this has led to a collapse of that embedded liberalism and the sense of a shared prospect that they all, those living in the US, can join in. That's my summary of what we've heard this morning about why Trump got elected. And I think this trade story is a central part of understanding that. And industrial policy, and industrial subsidies has been a response to this. Notice that it's protectionist. Notice the problems there's going to be in the border. We'll talk about that later. Trump has added tariffs and tax cuts, but at the core of this is a non-old-fashioned Marshallian economics response to a problem, which we don't yet know how to deal with and regulate internationally. Secondly, we've heard a lot about the market failure of innovation. Ideas cannot be captured by firms that invest, and because of that, there are strong, sensibly well-managed arguments for subsidies. And this support of domestic innovating firms will again be protectionist. And it's obviously being done in China, and that becomes a strong argument for it obviously being need to be done in the IRA in the US and in Europe. Everybody's doing this. And it's against the rules. That set of consensus practices would suggest that we ought to be able to do this, but we don't yet conceptually know how to do it and how to manage it internationally. Thirdly, learning by doing matters, dynamic comparative advantage. My story about Korea is just that if they'd listened to neoclassical economics in the 1950s, Korea would still be exporting rice. What that country learned to do was build behind a protectionist barrier a strong, dynamic, eventually able to export industry and grow. And the same is now true of many, the car industry, the battery industry, not just high-tech AI, but straightforward manufacturing stories. And again, the Chinese are doing it. And why shouldn't the Americans do it? And there's full, sensible, strong arguments for doing it. And it's against the rules. Next, and I just want to say, crucially, not yet been identified today, that when there are these strong economies of scale, subsidies and the argument for them becomes a really powerful one. Look at the story on the left there, where there's a demand for labour and you impose a subsidy and push up the marginal product curve of labour and shift the industry from there to there. If there are economies of scale that mean that this industry, this one, which is the what industry that we're interested in, over a period of expansion becomes better and better at doing stuff, then if you impose a subsidy, you can take this industry, which used to be there, and you can end up pushing it all the way to there. Multiple equilibria with economies of scale are really important. It's against the WTO rules, and it's important to do it. And of course, the move to net zero emissions is exactly like this too. That story of static and dynamic comparative advantage is central to the story of industrial transformation that comes with the transition to net zero. Multiple equilibria, radical policies necessary to shift the economies in this direction. So in sum, all four, and in fact I've listed five of these challenges, create scope for international conflict about what you're allowed to do. And our challenge is to recreate a system that enables us to do this. Now we ask, that's been, in a way, a race through some ideas. Now let's try and think about how these ideas can be made to work. And I'll be quick now. First of all, very quickly, for small countries, there's a question of the United Kingdom. How to play this in a way which doesn't lead to old-fashioned rent-seeking. And how to exert international influence in order to try and get the global system to be well-managed in the face of these challenges. And in this discussion that we have here today, we're thinking about the global system and the discussions between China and the US. How can an American first US led by President Trump be persuaded that it would be in the interests of this country to cooperate because the risk of not cooperating are just too large? There's a macroeconomic environment, which I won't go into in any detail, but just to note that the newly elected president wants to raise tariffs and cut taxes. And this is likely, both of these things, to lead a slowdown in the rest of the world, further endanger emerging market economies with their build-up of debt. And there's a risk that it won't end well in the US. We can talk about that risk, and deregulating the financial system is a good way to help making that risk even larger. And there's a very long-term macroeconomic environment that the world now needs to manage. Demographics here in China slowing, but a hugely rapidly growing labour force in Africa, this will require very large movements of capital from one part of the world to the other. Will it be risky? Yes. Will it be badly managed if there's financial deregulation? Yes. Can an American for America First US be persuaded that it should help manage these flows? That's our question. And now the summing up, where do we think the US might be in dealing with what I've been describing in this talk? I don't really need those two paragraphs at the beginning, because Stephen Barnett showed us this wonderful picture in red and green of China doing this and the US doing that as shares of the world economy. And they're just a longer-term version of the same thing. So how can you be a unipolar hegemon when that's happening to your share in the world economy? And how can you be a unipolar hegemon when the BRICS have a summit attended by China and Russia and many others with more than half of the world involved? So what does the new president want to do? Well, I've listed on the beginning of that slide some very bad things that we can all read about, and I read about them in a wonderful piece by Fukuyama in the Financial Times just last week. And we have to say, this is a president that's a deal maker, not a silly man, a capable, transactional deal maker who might actually do those rather dreadful things at the top of that slide. But two of our contributors earlier this morning, roughly speaking, said the opposite. A deal maker might find that the snippets that I've thrown out in my talk, whatever he's said up to now, might be snippets that say, wait a minute, the gains from, let's not use the word cooperation because the new US president doesn't like a word like that, but the gains from deal making to sort this world out in less of the problems that I've described might be ones that he just wants to join in on. And in particular, battling internationally to achieve technological dominance, once again deregulating and having incoherent macroeconomic policies might in the end not be what this deal maker is advised to do and decides to do. And that's my way of ending with hope. And you might say wishful thinking, mate, but I think that's the topic for our discussion. Can we be optimistic, or should we be, as so many people are, still pessimistic? Thank you very much, and thank you for your tolerance.
I
should like to say that Professor David Vines truly has a lot to offer. He talked about, first of all, the backgrounds to the establishment of the Bretton Woods system. And then he drew some comparison between the situation then and the situation today, highlighting some of the challenges that we have at the moment, for the moment. Now, here, let's have some comments. Now, I would like to clarify, we should have on our agenda Mr. Eric Bergloff, the chief economist from AIIB, to speak. But I'm sorry to say that because they have back in the bank a regulation saying that two top executives from the same bank could not attend an event at the same time. Therefore, Mr. Eric Bergloff is unable to speak here. Therefore, he's not speaking today. Now, my comments, first of all, I know that I met Professor David Vines about 10 years ago. At the time, we were talking about the Bretton Woods system at 70, and we were just having the event at the Bretton Woods location. I know I attended, and Professor Yongding of China also was there. And one morning, I was arranged on phone to go down to have my breakfast. And he told me that a professor by the name of David Wines was glad to see a paper written by a Chinese scholar. And actually, we wrote it, and then according to him, Professor Wines was highly interested in that paper. We did lay down very clearly the roadmap of the evolution of the international financial system. And I remember very clearly, because these were nice words for me to remember. And he later on, of course, we later on began to cooperate. Now, what Professor David Wines said impressed me on several particular issues. He actually combined the international monetary system with the domestic policies by quoting Keynes from his theory. You know, at the time, they were concerned about four aspects: full employment, promotion of economic development, etc. Now, I know that these were points on the minds of John Maynard Keynes when he was attending the conference talking about the establishment of the Bretton Woods system. Now, Keynes actually based himself on the situation at the time, including particularly that of the UK. Therefore, such a sort of a system came up from the depression at the time. Keynes was proud enough to say that he had the talent while the U.S. had only financial resources. He was, of course, a bit too optimistic because at the end of the day, still, I think the U.S. had their way. I therefore know that such a sort of historical episode is highly interesting to what we can do today. Anyhow, when we have the problems today, we need to have either or something similar that is such by multilateral negotiations. But for multilateralism to work, it's important to have some sort of a leadership. Therefore, leadership is important because it can mobilize the perspectives or opinions of different sides. And that is just what is needed today. We have a sort of a chaotic situation marked by multilateralism. So what is important is that there must be leadership. Leadership, therefore, is something pivotal. Now, we used to read a lot of articles about the Bretton Woods, about the collapse of the core Bretton Woods system. People call the current situation a sort of a no system. I should say we still have some sort of a system. We still have the U.S. dollar as the anchor. And you may no longer have the golden factors, that is the gold standard, yet you find that the U.S. dollar is still there at the very core of the system because it is now still the center, and a lot of other currencies are pegged to the U.S. dollar. Yet, still, there could be free adjustments. Now, we are very concerned about the exchanges, and since then we have had the fiat money, which is generally supported by the credibility of the government. The fiat money is, I think, something that has truly changed many of our thinkings. In the past, when they had the gold standard, then we would see that the system would be operating in that way. But now when we no longer have the gold standard, when we have the fiat money, then things could be highly different. So we would like to see whether Gresham's law will be working. Now, Gresham's law, I said. Now, Professor David Vines talked about the several challenges. Now, one of the challenges that globalization is, of course, developing, yet inequality is developing as well. So the gap is widening between different groups of countries. On the other hand, we see that globalization, free trade, etc., have to quite a great extent narrowed the gap between countries. And we also see that people lifted out of poverty are growing. But domestically, maybe things could be different. That is to say, globalization might be widening the inequality domestically. So we don't know in what way we can really make globalization better. by making it really help the poor, particularly those in the underdeveloped countries.
I met with a professor from Harvard in Europe early on, and he said that Europeans have done a better job than the Americans in narrowing down the gap between the rich and the poor. And actually, some professors even believe that many people have exaggerated the negative impacts of trade globalization, but many people have underestimated or even ignored the benefits brought about by trade globalization. So that was my first question. And the second question, Professor David Vines talked about Trump probably would increase tariff and cut tax domestically, and then that could negatively impact the global economic system, and also negatively impact the many countries in the world. But my question is, how will that impact on U.S. deficit? I mean, during the election campaigns, the Republican candidate and the Democrat candidate, neither of them has talked about deficit, the increasing deficit of U.S. government. Of course, that's is easy to understand. In order to win voters, they all make promises, but they touched nothing, almost nothing, on the deficit. So right now, based on the data I have, it's about $35 trillion right now. And so many people agree that it's not going to be sustainable. But it seems that we have no way out. I asked Jason Fermat, the chairman of the Presidential Advisor Committee, and Axel Weber, who was UOBS's chairman, and also the chairman or the president of Swiss Central Bank. But of course, my question is a little bit provoking and difficult. And I asked them, you know that current deficit level is unsustainable. Then what is the tipping point? And do you have any standard or criteria to define, you know, the sustainability of the deficit, right? So I'm asking this question again here. For David or, you know, all participants today. So that's all from me. Thank you. Sorry, I've overrun. Sorry. So Mr. Chow gave very insightful commentary and raised two questions. Shall I give the floor to David first? Could you answer the question first?
When you run a very large fiscal deficit, it tends to end up as a current account deficit. The mechanism by which that happens is that such a large fiscal deficit threatens to cause inflation and requires the Federal Reserve to raise its interest rates, and that will appreciate the currency. And so what starts as a deficit spending stimulus ends up as a loss of competitiveness and thus a current account deficit. When you put on top of this tariffs, those tariffs divert spending on imports that would have been on imports to spending on domestic goods, adding further to the pressure on demand at home, increasing the pressure on the central bank to raise interest rates and appreciating the currency. It's a straightforward paradox that an increase in the tariff level generally, not just one particular country, China, but generally, can end up having no effect on the current account deficit because you simply end up less competitive because your exchange rate has appreciated. So, combination of tax cuts and tariffs is good rhetoric, but it's not. It will not help improve the current account of the balance of payments. It will do exactly the opposite. And I think you probably agree with me about that too.
我加一句，我
I would like to add something I forgot to mention. I mean, US or USD has something special about it because USD is the global reserve currency. So that means that US in a better position to manage its deficit because other countries in the world are buying up U.S. treasuries, reducing burden on U.S. government. But the transmission mechanism you mentioned, of course, is there, is valid. However, because it's unique position, I don't think it will be, the transmission mechanism will play the level of role as you describe. I don't know if you agree or not.
What you say about the balance sheet is really important, and it might not, as I've said, improve the actual current account of the balance of payments. With a stronger dollar, less competitive, yes, but with a stronger dollar and a balance sheet worth more in the world, the US will at least gain that way. It's not a good way to improve your balance sheet, is the final throwaway remark that I would make. But let's discuss this some more afterwards.
Thank you. We have two more speakers. The first one is Mr. Zhu Xian, Vice President and Secretary General of International Finance Forum and former Vice President of the World Bank. So, Mr. Zhu, please. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak on this very important symposium. I spoke last year as well. I didn't prepare a presentation, so I'll just make my presentation based on the summary I have prepared. I would like to make some comments on the 80th anniversary of the establishment of a Bretton Woods system. This is a big topic. If you look at the system and its institutions, these two concepts are related but different. You all mentioned, you know, the 1971 collapse of the core of the Bretton Woods system. However, the world has been keeping on. But the Bretton Woods institutions, the three pillars, IMF, World Bank, and the WTO, they survive the collapse. So I would like to focus on these institutions, particularly the World Bank and also NDBs, multilateral development banks. I would like to, based on my experience, share with you some of my observations on them. This year marks the 80th anniversary of the establishment of the Bretton Woods system. We can briefly look back into history when it was set up in 1944. At the time, World War II was not yet coming to an end, but we already saw the dawn of victory. And well, at the time, superpowers were mainly, actually, superpower was the U.S. President Roosevelt and the American government at the time were very visionary. Why do I say that? Because they were already starting to consider, you know, how to establish a new international political and economic governance system after the war. And the political system, UN, of course, and then the economic system. Actually, Professor Feinz has already given us a very detailed introduction, the three pillars, the IMF, the World Bank, MBRD, and also the not yet established World Trade Organization of the time. So my first observation is that, at that time, it was already a quite achievement with the establishment of the three institutions and also the Bretton Woods system, it had a profound impact in the following 70 to 80 years. Well, I mean, if we look back, near the end of the World War II, U.S., you know, had this big initiative, which of course it was in line with the U.S. interest, but also in line with the global interest. Last week, President Trump put forward the America First slogan. I think it was very different from what President Roosevelt proposed at the time, and it was really ironic. So if we look at Bretton Woods system, we have to talk about the institutions as well. Otherwise, we could be too subjective. We need to consider those institutions as well. I've been working with I worked with the World Bank for 18 years. And if you look at other MDBs, like Asia Development Bank, not AIB, and also the New Development Bank, actually, altogether, I've been working with these international financial institutions or MDBs for nearly four decades. I either work with them or I've been, dealing with them. And so my opinions just represent myself, I do not represent IMF or WTO. Okay, so let me put forward my conclusion first. Though Bretton Woods system has its flaws and institutions have their own problems, but overall speaking, in English, if we choose between with and without and think with them, it's better than without being without them. And I think their existence actually has given us more benefits than drawbacks to the world, particularly for the developing countries. If we look at last round's globalization, including free trade, including market-based economy, and think these institutions have done a very good job and a positive contribution to the development of these efforts. This morning, I had a brief talk with President Jing, and about 30 years ago, we used to work with the Ministry of Finance in China, and we were dealing a lot with these multilateral institutions. I remember clearly that 1 year in Madrid, there was this annual meeting of the World Bank IMF, and when the World Bank president was making a presentation, suddenly, you know, a banner dropped and said, which said 50 years is enough. So you can see that the global sentiment at the time was already against, these multilateral institutions, against the Bretton Woods institutions. And so these challenges still persist today. However, the crisis, if you compare with 30 years ago, I think the level of the risk has dropped significantly. Now, I would like to talk a little bit about the pros and cons or benefits and drawbacks of multilateral financial institutions represented by the World Bank. But this is my personal observation because I have already retired, so I can be more frank and honest in my opinions. Okay, so first of all, about their governance structure, in UN, one country has one vote, but it's different with these organizations.
These institutions are different from the United States, United Nations. When the war, Second World War, was drawing to its end, then it's natural that the developed countries, particularly the United States, had a predominant position in shaping that. Now the world is different. We cannot have just a handful of countries making the decision for the rest. We have those emerging economies, which take up about 60% of the total world GDP. Therefore, I know that those emerging economies find themselves not fully represented in the quota, in the voting rights, etc. China is just one of them. I know that this is a very different situation. About 10 years ago, the AIIB and the New Development Bank were established just as a reflection of the Chinese wishes to readdress the international order. At the same time, of course, it was they were all also to be installed to complement what was already there. Now, we find that the developed countries, they can always, of course, have their way or their say in a lot of in a lot of issues, whether for development or for assistance. I know at the outset, the World Bank was viewed mostly as a sort of assistance institution. And then such assistance was rendered to the underdeveloped countries with the decisions made primarily by the developed countries. But now, of course, the situation should be very different because you see that we have those emerging countries are setting up their own institutions, and therefore the international financial scenario is already changed. Now, we need to see whether the World Bank should now transition to its new role, which is no longer just a sort of assistance institution. It can also function as a sort of a bank of something like of a last resort. Therefore, I should say that for the middle-income countries, they therefore are no longer to be the target for the development assistance. They should be viewed as partners or the shareholders in a cooperative. Therefore, I think we should no longer view the World Bank as a sort of assistance provider. Therefore, it's a view of the developing countries should also change. I know that those emerging economies like the middle-income countries, they are now having internationally and domestically, they have the ways or resources to mobilize funds. Therefore, the situation is truly very different from what it was, let's say, 10 years ago. Against this background, the multilateral banking institutions must change their roles as well. Now, just now, Professor David Wines said that the World Bank had its role differently set up from, let's say, the IMF. But now it seems that the line is blurred between the World Bank and the IMF. We see that World Bank is now involved more and more in development decisions. We should say that in principle, the World Bank should not get involved too much in the salvaging of countries in crises. On the other hand, the International Monetary Fund should not function or get involved too much in development promotion. So you can see that the lines are blurred simply because those institutions, including their staff, all struggle to survive. Therefore, they are expanding their portfolios. That's something understandable, but still we need to make a sort of a demarcation line between them. And then in the history of those institutions, particularly in the history of World Bank, because of, for example, the choice made by the U.S. or preference of the U.S., then certain countries were put under sanctions by the World Bank, and that's something worrying to me. This means that geopolitical interventions could truly become a source of direct influence on certain countries. I know that Mao Pass was named to replace Jin Yong when Donald Trump was elected for the first time. And I know that during Trump administration 1.0, said that climate change should not be put on the policy agenda. And therefore, the new World Bank president did not, therefore, or put any emphasis on climate change agenda. Therefore, Mao Pass, later, of course, Mao Pass was replaced later on by an Indian-American. So that was the change, reflecting the political change in the White House. And I know that this time Donald Trump again is in the White House, and he has also threatened to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Agreement. Therefore, we are concerned whether, for example, the green items would still be supported by the World Bank. So you can see that domestic politics is truly interfering with the agenda of those institutions. And this is not at all any sort of a good news. And then about the evolution of the products of those institutions, and about the pros and cons of such changes. I know that the World Bank is focused on infrastructure revamping, social policies, Washington Consensus items, and then public goods provision to the climate change agenda, etc. All these changes reflected the changes or the changing concerns of the international community. Now, such changes, of course, were more a sort of accumulation of the additions without, at the same time, the shredding or discarding of the old things. So you see, it's like a sort of a Christmas tree with a lot of presents or gifts hanged onto the branches of the trees. So it is becoming all too big in the scope of the portfolio. I think for the World Bank, what is important is that it should provide policy recommendations, and they provide loans or other kinds of assistance in line with such policy recommendations. And at the same time, then, what is really the in what way can we hold the decision makers of the World Bank accountable if some of their policies are not really reaping the expected results? And we all know very well the Washington Consensus, and such a sort of a consensus did not at all consider, for example, the fragility of the situation in certain countries. So that's also a serious defect. Now, for the World Bank, its products are the loans, and the good thing is that these loans are, in many cases, long-term loans, otherwise not available to those underdeveloped or developing or emerging countries. I know that the World Bank has its procedures in making assessment of the projects and then conducting the feasibility studies, etc. Now, such procedures are, of course, very good for other multilateral institutions and also even for the domestic financial institutions. But at the same time, we find that they have not been very innovative in this line of business. And we also see that the AAA projects of the bank have very low interest rates. Therefore, in time, they have become very conservative. And the financial management in particular is very conservative. It tends to only focus on the government side rather than the private sector. Therefore, this is not helping to, let's say, tap the resources of the private sector. Because, for example, even if you can loan out, let's say, 100 billion U.S. dollars, still that's a very small portion, unable to meet the requirements of the developing countries. So the very conservative financial management is making this bank unable to, therefore, reduce the debt, unable to, therefore, provide debt relief to those recipients of the loans. I know that, therefore, even though the World Bank is calling on a lot of institutions or countries to provide relief, it is itself not doing this. Therefore, it does not have the moral legitimacy, or the legitimacy is not at all high. So I should like to say that over the past 8 years, we have seen the evolution of the institutions and their businesses as well as the ways of doing things. And we see that there were certain good points and at the same time bad points as well. So we should draw upon the historical experience to improve the current situation. I know China benefited quite a lot from the World Bank and other institutions. I know that we, therefore, are thankful to the institutions, but we do hope that such institutions can improve themselves, for example, by getting further away from politics and really getting closer to the actual needs of the countries in efficient and flexible ways. So that is our expectation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zhu. And Mr. Zhu has been working with international institutions for decades, and he has given us a very detailed picture of these institutions from five perspectives. I'm not going to repeat what he has said. Next, I will give the floor to Ms. Yu Ye, Assistant Director of the Institute for World Economy Studies, Shanghai Institutes for International Studies, the dilemma of the security development nexus and the challenges of fulfilling the World Bank's mission. Thank you. Thank you, moderator. And also, I would like to thank Mr. Chiao for inviting me to speak here. I feel very honored to be able to have this chance to have discussions and dialogues with heavyweight speakers around the world. So the topic of my presentation actually is focusing on development, how to develop. This is not only issue that Bretton Woods system tries to address. It is also about It's also about how we can, you know, integrate security and development together so as to establish a new international development system. I remember that a couple of days ago, President Pan Jie, he said that actually now we are marking the 80th anniversary of the Bretton Woods system, and we are facing similar crossroads. Or, well, 80 years ago, it was about the reconstruction of EU. Now we are talking about the reconstruction of developing countries or countries facing conflicts. So it seems that we are repeating history here. However, my point is that we are still in a different situation, because 80 years ago, it was about post-war reconstruction. It was about international rejuvenation and development. Well, at the time, the IRD, or today's World Bank, was talking about, you know, what should be the main mission. Should be reconstruction or development? But later it was defined that development should be it should be reconstruction first and then development. But at the time, reconstruction was about improving productivity. But today we are in a different world, and when we talk about international development system, it's no longer, I mean, it's more than infrastructure investment. So our mission today is broader than the mission defined for IBRC of the time. So at the time, it's mostly about economic considerations. It was mostly about economic considerations rather than political factors. And MDBs around the world have been trying to follow this philosophy. So 80 years onwards, development is still a key idea. But when we talk about development today, we have to look at it together with security. And particularly so after the end of the Cold War in the 1990s. After the Cold War, the attention changed from national security to individual security and safety, including health and safety and education, etc. These are all included into the broader concept of security. So I'd like to talk about the evolution of the international development system, and then try to analyze the challenges faced by the World Bank. Actually, the World Bank today is more than about reconstructions. It has more to its mission today. And also, China and other OECD countries, and I mean China and OECD countries, they also have a lot of issues regarding, you know, security and development, which should go first. I understand the World Bank is undertaking reforms, and some say that it's going to be changed into a climate bank. And many scholars have been studying the relationship of the World Bank and other organizations. But I don't think that the World Bank's position will be downgraded, like particularly regarding concessional resources, but it may have some impact regarding non-concessional loans. But overall speaking, we don't have to be concerned with the position of the World Bank. So let me come back to the topic of development, the relationship between security and development. I think that For China, our position is clear. We focus on our domestic politics and we just focus on developing our infrastructure. And World Bank, of course, plays an important role in bridging security and development. And I think that this challenge is also faced by the Bretton Woods system 80 years ago. Now, we have still have countries in deep conflicts. So how can we, you know, facilitate peace through development for these countries? We still don't have an answer. And this is indeed a serious challenge. Well, after the Cold War, everybody knows that people start to talk about the relationship or connectivity between security and development. Without security, then we won't achieve development. And without development, we won't achieve security. And this is also the idea that has been followed in China. Here I have included some literature for your reference. I'm not going to details here. So this is... I mean, for OECD countries, they have been reflecting on how to achieve effective development. So their core philosophy is that to facilitate development, we have to address the national security issues. So how to address security issues, then we should have a peace building and we should start with institution building. So this has become the core of the OECD's philosophy. In 2007, OECD adopted, I think it was after 9/11, that security had attracted more attention. So after the 9/11, we have this new concept of fragile states. So OECD adopted the principle. They have this Development Assistance Committee, which gives guidance on development assistance. So it's not about security, it's about development. So their principle is that for these fragile states, we need to build up institutions in these states. And then we talk about just development. So obviously, it's security before development. It was about... systems and institutions before hardware infrastructure. So this is the philosophy, but this is also why these conflicts with the Belt and Road development philosophy of China, because China's position is that we don't interfere in other countries' domestic issues, and we focus on infrastructure development first, and then we talk about security. And then 2030, but with the adoption of 2030 agenda, peace has become an important part of development. And so peace as a sustainable development goal is formally linked with security. In Afghanistan and also Iraq, after the wars, and people talk about, you know, how to achieve securitization of development. So when we talk about, you know, link between security and development, it's a positive term. But when we talk about securitization of development, it's a degradatory term. Many people talk about securitization today, they mostly talk about, you know, the military providing assistance to the countries in conflict. For example, U.S., a lot of 20% of assistance provided by U.S. to Afghanistan actually were done through its Ministry of Defense. And I said earlier that when we talk about development and securitization, it was degradatory term. And in fact, after 9/11, after the terrorist attack, now people no longer focus on development. People focus more on the protection of a country's security and their own security, and also the rise of refugees, is particularly cross-border refugees, have led to new concerns about security. So Now people are talking about the new Cold War. So in such a new discourse system, how can we better manage the risks? How can we address the challenges? So this actually has exacerbated the complexity of the so-called securitization of development. I'm not going to details about it now because today's topic is about the World Bank. So the World Bank, as I said earlier, is a leader in building the link between security and development. And so I think this is the right topic for today's symposium on the Bretton Woods system. Well, about fragile state. This is based on the World Bank's idea of institution and governance first and then followed by development. So this idea was put forward by the World Bank in 1996. At the time, we had a new president, Wilson, and he had to deal a lot of corruption, and the World Bank also had a lot of issues at the time. So after 50 years, so that's why governance, it was included into the agenda of the World Bank. So it was about 3 years earlier than OECD's program. So in this sense, the World Bank has been leading the development security nexus agenda. I'm not going to details here. Anyway, and so such an idea then leads to a connection with the agenda of UN, and also leads to new strategies for the World Bank. However, it has also brought about new challenges. I think that IDA actually has been squeezed because of the needs by those fragile states. So a lot of money have been put into those countries in conflict rather than being used for real long-term development. So for the World Bank, you know, many people are talking about the possibility of a climate bank. IDA is the biggest window to access preferential treatment resources. So we have many, you know, special windows for fragile states, etc. So in other words, a lot of resources have been diverted to addressing conflicts, to addressing humanitarian crisis. So for countries receiving aids or assistance, MDBs usually require these countries to make changes, but then they won't receive money on time. So it's very difficult for them to use their own resources to address vulnerabilities such as climate change challenges. So the fragile states that are facing, you know, major challenges such as limited availability of resources. Well, in the academic world, we have this agreement that the so-called security development nexus has failed, and the so-called freedom and peace it has also failed. As I said, these countries, they need a lot of resources, and World Bank has to provide them with support.
Now, for those countries in conflict, they are in a very difficult situation. And I know that the staff of the World Bank and other institutions have even been involved in the local actions. So in this way, we know that the cost is also not very high for those institutions. Now, in the current era of focus shift to security, I should like to say that many of the visions or principles or the missions of globalization are now affected. Therefore, we have to rethink about those things. I am very sorry to say that I have not enough time to talk about the details of some of my conclusions. So let me just stop here. Thank you very much. Thank you, Professor Ye. Thank you for controlling the time very well. Now, this is truly the time for coffee, but still, I would like to see if there are any questions from our audience or any comments. We can still use a couple of minutes for discussions. Now, please. I have a question because it was mentioned that the World Bank has its certain practices for handling debt. I know that for the within the G20 framework, those debt countries could go into certain procedures to get relief for their debt. I would like to know, therefore, the emergency clauses are available to those poor countries or fragile countries. Now, in what way can we really cooperate better to facilitate such a process? First of all, I should like to say that I no longer represent the World Bank because I left quite some time ago. And I do not know the recent figures of the debt related with the World Bank. I know that, generally speaking, the staff of the World Bank actually is very resistant to debt relief because that can affect the AAA status of the World Bank. I know some African countries cannot repay or pay back the loans, then the official position of the World Bank is that if you do not pay back, then you can never have new loans. And sometimes the World Bank might suggest a sort of alternative, that is, those former colonies could go to their colonizing mother country, for example, go to France for assistance, and then the World Bank would help them with the facilitation of getting such assistance. And then, as other ways, we could, for example, negotiate with those countries so that they can have some bridge arrangements. That is to say, after they succeed in, you know, getting agreement with a certain third party institutions, then we could give you new loans. So that is the general practice of the World Bank. Thank you. Now, I have heard with great interest the reflections on the Bretton Woods institutions. Now, let me just share with you some of my comments. I think the Bretton Woods institutions are multilateral institutions. So the Bretton Woods system is a sort of a multilateral system. And the U.S. at the time was, after all, a sort of a big holder of the gold of the world. But later, of course, the U.S. was unable to support it just with its gold because the gold was draining away. And therefore, the U.S. used its government credibility. And as Triffany Dilemma told us, then the U.S. must be in chronic deficit status to pump US dollars into the world economy. So that's a way to make the system to survive. But if Donald Trump wishes to make the U.S. a game by really always putting the other countries in deficit rather than in surplus, then we might see a shortage of the U.S. dollar in the international market. That might make the international system very difficult to operate. So now that the gold system, gold standard is gone, and the no system is also in peril, what will we do in the future? Now, so please tell us to whom you are raising your question. I know that your points are, of course, valid, and my idea that, first of all, the U.S. efforts to reduce the deficit of the U.S. Are not necessarily going to succeed. We don't know whether Trump is going to succeed in his efforts. Secondly, you know, for the international balance sheet, we have the current account, and also we have the other accounts or accounts. Therefore, even when the trade deficit is to shrink or even disappear for the U.S., still we can have the capital account, which could still pump the U.S. dollar into the international market. But of course, your idea is generally still valid. That is to say, we could still be concerned about the policy of the government that holds the reserve currency. Now, some people say that the reserve currencies are the same for all, but actually it's another case. This is only a sort of a situation for the U.S. And also, please don't say that any currency that is to be internationalized must incur the deficit for the holding country. That is for the country that holds the reserve currency. It's another case. I know my question is that if the a currency is overvalued, it is not at all good for the manufacturing of the country. Now, for the U.S. And the U.S. dollar, it is in a very special position. It will continue with its current status if there is no other currency to replace it. Now, I think all the countries or governments are simply very concerned about the security of the cash or the currency of the currencies at hand. Therefore, I should say that the credibility of the U.S. is still the highest. This is not any result of any administrative arrangement. It's a choice of most of the people. Now, I would like to use the prerogative of my chairship. That is, let me just ask this question. That is, in international politics and international financial operations, we now talk too much about security. That is the geopolitical security. So therefore, security is now more or less abused as a term. by people in the community? This is another question, therefore, Professor Yi does not have to answer because we need to have the time for coffee break. So let's have 10 minutes of coffee break, please. See you in 10 minutes.